Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Hallett. Well, what a week for University of Louisville athletics in particular and the university itself in general. Last night, the football team defeated Rutgers to earn a berth in a major bowl, probably the Orange Bowl or Sugar Bowl. Tomorrow, the U of L men's soccer team will play Maryland for a chance to advance to the NCAA Final Four in Alabama. And of course, back on the Wednesday morning, the decision was made to admit U of L into the Atlantic Coast Conference. U of L will move all of its sports to the ACC, leaving the increasingly unstable Big East, which has seen some key members defect to other conferences in recent years. U of L will join the ranks of schools in the ACC, such as Duke, Virginia, North Carolina, Notre Dame. And joining us to talk about how all this transpired and what it all means are Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston and WFPO's Joseph Lord. Welcome, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks, Rick.
We were planned to have Eric Crawford of WDRB and WDRB.com to be with us today to talk about it. Apparently, he has been detained, but if he comes in during the segment, we'll let him join in the conversation. Well, let's go back. U of L has had a number of conference affiliations over the years, including the Missouri Valley Conference, the Metro Conference, Conference USA, and then on to the Big East, I guess about 8 or 9 years ago, and now the Atlantic Coast Conference. Who knows what the future holds, but Kenny, this would seem to be really a destination conference for U of L.
Yeah, it is one of the big conferences historically. I mean, the ACC has been around for a long time. They're in the same conversation as the Big Ten, the Pac-12, the SEC. This is a destination conference. And this is something that I think Louisville's been fighting for, as you mentioned, for a long time. I mean, every conference they've gotten into, they've made it seem like, well, this might be our final resting place, yeah. And then conference realignment blows up. And it still could. I mean, there's still chatter about whether the ACC is really stable or not. But for the time being, it is stable, and this is a big, big move for the University of Louisville, both in for basketball, for football, and also academically. I mean, you could argue that the ACC is right there with the Big Ten when it comes to academics as well, which would be a big help to the university.
And Joe, it seems like there was in recent weeks, especially, really some hand wringing after the Big East schools, other Big East schools began to scamper, and U of L wasn't really hearing any overtures. And right. Even this week, there was concern that the ACC would invite Connecticut to join the conference.
Right, right. I think this move took a lot of people by surprise, especially Wednesday morning when the news started to break that the ACC's presidents would start would consider this, and that Louisville was the likely pick. If you looked at the national commentators, they just days before were saying that this looked like it was UConn's, and ended up going to U of L.
And there were some concerns raised, and a lot of writing and talk about it here locally about first academics at U of L,
right,
helping get into the conference, and the size of the TV market.
Right, right. The TV market compared to Connecticut, which isn't far from New York, their TV market was more thought to be a little more impressive. But the ACC, the chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill, during a conference call right after the announcement was made, said that they were looking for the most exciting sports program. And then he was pressed on the academics issue because the ACC does make a big deal about its academics. As UNC is a very good school. Virginia is a very good school. Duke is one of the top schools in the country. And he said that they felt that, yes, if you look at the rankings, U of L is not where Virginia is or UNC or especially Duke. But he said that they appear to be on the right trajectory is the word he used. So.
Yeah, I think the key here is twofold. Number one, I think what you saw the ACC do is there's a lot of talk. This realignment is really about TV markets and revenue. And while Hartford, Connecticut may be a bigger TV market, I think what they saw is how many people actually watch Connecticut football or Connecticut basketball in terms of what they do here in Louisville. And I think when they said an exciting sports team, a lot of people are complaining Maryland leaves the ACC to the Big Ten, and a lot of people are saying, who's going to watch a Northwestern university versus the University of Maryland? Yeah, exactly. But a lot more people might watch the University of Louisville versus, let's say, North Carolina or Duke in both sports, Florida State. And then the other thing is, U of L got outmaneuvered in the Big 12 when West Virginia kind of outflanked them in conference realignment the time before this. And I just think the university made a decision that we're not going to be outflanked again.
So what's the timetable? What happens next? When do they join the conference?
I believe it's 2014 is when they start joining the conference. What you're going to see now is I think some of the people who are leaving the ACC, Maryland is going to have to talk about a buyout. Of course, U of L will have a buyout as well. And I think Big East teams are supposed to give 27 months of notice before they leave. But as we've seen with Pittsburgh and Syracuse and a few other of these schools, Rutgers is also on its way to the Big Ten. They usually pay a little bit more money and they get out a little sooner. The ACC probably wouldn't take Louisville before the 2014 sports season. That being said, that conflicts with the Big East timetable, but Louisville is one of the most profit university athletics programs in the nation. So when you talk about a buyout, that's not going to be a big deal for Louisville. They have that cash sitting there.
Right. And the ACC officials said that they expect to put Louisville into Maryland's scheduling area, so they whatever plans they have for scheduling, they will just sort of move Louisville right in.
So, Joe, I know you talked to someone over at the with the faculty over at U of L, and there's been we've been kind of investigating how this will benefit the academic and research side of the university.
It was pretty interesting. You don't tend to think of athletics and academics, them working together, oddly enough, at a college sports program. But Jill Steffen, the president of the Faculty Senate at the University of Louisville, we talked recently, and he said that, yes, there can be effect. Sometimes conferences, and he wasn't aware that the ACC does this, but they have exchanges of faculty or things like that, where they're actually cooperating with the other schools in the conference. There's also the fact that they'll be affiliated with schools like Virginia and Duke. Just being in the same breath as those schools helps their reputation. And then now that the teams will be playing in the state of Virginia and the state of North Carolina, where they don't play a lot these days, they'll be able to attract more students from those areas too.
And before we run out of time, I want to talk about last night's big game. U of L beat Rutgers 20-17 to win a share of the Big East title and get the league's bid to one of the top-tier BCS bowls, probably the Orange Bowl or the Sugar Bowl. There was also a report out this week that Charlie Strong, the coach, had at least had some sort of conversation or interview with Auburn, which has a coaching vacancy. It fired its coach. He said it never happened. But there's going to be a lot of other opportunities for him to interview. I guess I'm asking you to speculate, but you think he's going to stick around?
Well, I mean, getting to a BCS Bowl always twofold. Number one, he's gotten to a BCS Bowl, so there's a lot of job security there. Not that he was on the hot seat anyways. Mm. Also, the ACC, you know, they're not in the sinking Titanic that is the Big East, so Strong does not have to worry about being a lower tier guy. But you know, a lot of his career was at Florida as a defensive coordinator. I believe he's from Arkansas, who has a vacancy. You know, and the SEC is the dominant football conference, and these coaches are usually ambitious. They want to cut their teeth, you know, in the best conferences. But the other thing to remind people of here is that when you talk about, when a coach goes for a job search or to apply, it's not like when we go to apply for a job. These guys have agents who work in different cities. So Charlie Strong may have never talked to anybody at Auburn. The question is, did his agent ever reach out to Auburn? It's going to be a funny song and dance, but obviously going to a bowl now and being in the ACC gives Louisville a lot more arguments to say, Charlie Strong, just stay where you're at.
Right. And you can also say, well, maybe he was talking to even if he didn't actually talk, there's always he might want a contract extension. Yeah. So this is
that's what we saw with Les Miles at LSU. Yeah. He rumored to be talking with Arkansas, and all of a sudden he got a nice big fat extension at LSU.
Mm-hmm. This is how the game is played.
Exactly.
Joe Lord, Kenny Colston, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having
me. Sir.
This is Byline on WFPL. This week in Indianapolis, the superintendent of Indiana State Police testified before the State Budget Committee, which is hearing funding requests from various agencies in advance of the 2013 General Assembly. It was mostly a routine hearing, but Superintendent Paul Weitzel raised some eyebrows when he answered a question about legislative efforts to decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana.
Well, the marijuana issue has been a perennial problem for my nearly 40 years now of law enforcement. It has not gone away. I am certain it won't go away. I heard it referred to as a victimless crime back in the 60s when I was in school. I've seen it penetrate virtually every strata of our social content there is. I have tremendous resources of state police, personnel invested in chasing that issue. My thought is, after and toward the zenith of my career, I'd say it's here, it's going to stay. That's an awful lot of victimization that goes with it. If it were up to me, I do believe I would legalize it and tax it, particularly in sight of the fact that several other states have now come to that part of their legal system as well.
White so went on to suggest that the state could set up a system to collect a marijuana tax and keep track of those who obtain, this is my word, permits or some sort of registration or registry of, I guess, marijuana users. So how likely is marijuana decriminalization or legalization to occur anytime soon in Indiana? Well, here to talk about that is Ed Feigenbaum, longtime State House political analyst and publisher of Indiana Legislative Insight. Ed, welcome to the program.
Great to be back with you, Rick. Thank you.
I was monitoring this budget hearing when Superintendent Whitesell made his remarks, and I went back and listened to the tape several times before I wrote my story to make sure I heard him right. Did this cause some shockwaves at the State House?
Well, only coming from him, yes. And the state police as an agency quickly walked back his comments, saying he was just kind of speaking for himself. It wasn't a legal opinion, didn't represent the agency's opinion. But he was absolutely speaking from his heart and from his perspective of 40 years in law enforcement. And the reason that the question was asked is probably more important than the question itself for the purposes of which you just asked, and that's that it's not really a surprise that this issue is being discussed right now in the Indiana General Assembly. We had some rumblings over the last several months that this would be an issue in 2013. And I think the first real clue that this would come up again came in the form of a resolution from a senator, a Democratic senator from Northwest Indiana, who sought a study committee on this over the summer, and the Senate agreed to it. And that kind of surprised some people. And then over the course of the last couple of weeks of the session, we had retirements, you know, the usual legislative retirements. And one of the guys who was stepping down was a guy by the name of Representative Tom Nolman from Union County, Liberty, just west of the Ohio border in east central Indiana. And Tom Nolman was a guy who'd been in the legislature for about only two terms, and a youngish guy, and he suffers from multiple sclerosis. And the reason that he stepped aside is he said it just really wasn't practical for him to continue to come to Indianapolis and try and perform his duties. He said he was in constant pain. He had tried some stem cells.
Ed, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Ed. We're getting short on time, and I apologize for that. But there are got about 30 seconds left. There are a couple of bills that are going to be pending in the session, correct?
Right, and that's partially because of Nolman and some concern for Nolman, some people who want to decriminalize it and allow medical marijuana, and then the new chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, very conservative member from Bedford, is concerned about the literal cost of the harsher laws, and he wants to do something to rid the state prisons of some of these nonviolent offenders.
Ed, I'm sorry we're short on time. Thank you so much for joining us. Ed Feigenbaum with the State House analyst in Indianapolis. Thanks, Ed. We'll be back with more in a moment. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanksgiving has come and passed, and we now look ahead to Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, or other end-of-year celebrations you might be observing. Joel Gerth of the Courier-Journal still has turkey on his mind. This week he published his fifth annual Leftover Turkeys Turkey Column, which he calls that once-a-year celebration of the miscues, misstatements, and miscreants of the area's political scene. And he joins us now to talk about his list. Hey, Joe.
How are you doing?
Fine. Welcome back.
Thanks much.
Well, as usual, no shortage of political turkeys of all political stripes, or I guess I should say feathers in this case, to recognize this year. And topping your list is Indiana State Treasurer Richard Murdoch, who ran for the U.S. Senate.
That's right. Murdoch, as you may recall, during a debate over at IU Southeast in New Albany, made the statement that pregnancies that come of rape are what God intended. And with that, he pretty much sank his chances of becoming the next U.S. senator from Indiana.
And that office has been captured by the Democrat, Joe Donnelly.
Joe Donnelly, who was trailing in the polls at that point. The Democrats' efforts to kind of create the idea that the Republicans were waging a war on women had kind of slowed at that point. But gosh darn it, Richard Murdoch got that going again, and he paid for it politically. So
next on the list is a Democrat, and that would be Congressman Ben Chandler in the 6th District, who lost the election as well to Republican Andy Barr.
That's right. Everybody thought that Chandler was going to do better this time than he did 2 years ago when he beat Barr by only about, 650 votes. The district was made pretty substantially more Democratic through redistricting, but Chandler had problems in this election. He ran some ads in which they focused on an arrest that Andy Barr had when he was in college for using a fake ID. A lot of people thought that was a mistake, that it was just it's the kind of thing that everybody does, or a lot of people does, and Barr just happened to get caught. And thought that was a little bit over the top, and that could have played a role in his losing to Barr this time around.
So just a side note, what does Chandler do now in your estimation?
Lays low for a few election cycles. It is usually bad for a politician to jump right back in after a loss. I think we saw that with Ann Northup, who ran for governor shortly after she lost and ran again for the U.S. House a year later. So that tends to be a mistake that some politicians make. Chandler was lucky enough the first time that after he lost his run for governor, because Ernie Fletcher was from the same district as he and was vacating a seat, he had a chance to run. He had name recognition, made it easier for him. But, you know, for the most part, politicians need to back up if they've been thrown out of office and take a little bit of time.
He wasn't exactly thrown out of office, but Steve Beshear did that. He ran for governor and lost, and then kind of went off and practiced law and coached baseball and that sort of thing and came back.
Ran for Senate, lost there, went back, coached baseball, ran a law office, came back, ran for governor, finally won. That's right.
Well, also on your list, Richie Farmer.
What can you say about Richie Farmer? Gosh darn it, he just keeps giving. After we found out that he hired his girlfriend at a pretty substantial salary at the end of last year, we come back this year, find out he was doing things like shooting at deer from the cab of his state pickup truck. We don't know yet what's going to come of that. There are some folks still looking at it. Don't know if there are going to be any sort of criminal charges filed coming out of his years as agriculture commissioner, but there were some problems over there, and we can continue to learn about them throughout this year. He's now, I guess, back in Manchester selling cars.
Yeah, so he got a job at an auto dealership, but he's not criminally charged with anything at this
point. Not at this point. I know there's some folks still looking at it. I don't know if anything's going to come of that or not, but obviously it was not a well-run office if you take the auditor's report for what it says.
Yeah. Also, you raised a question about some folks who hired former state Democratic Party Chairman Jerry Johnson to the post at the University of Louisville Medical School.
That's right. That hire raises lots of questions. For one, Jerry Johnson doesn't have a college degree. Now, I'm not an intellectual snob. Don't get me wrong. I don't think you need to have a college degree to be successful in this world. In fact, I know a heck of a lot of people who don't have college degrees and are very extremely successful. The problem with this is that he works for a university, which where should you value college degrees more than at a university? Also thrown into that, he had a conviction some 30 years ago for cocaine possession. It raises lots of questions about why he got the job, whether he is truly qualified or whether it's just that he is very well politically connected. And we'll let folks decide that on their own, I guess.
We're talking to Joe Girth of the Courier-Journal. And finally, on your political turkeys list, this is a sweeping indictment of the majorities of the Kentucky House and Senate and the way they handled redistricting this year.
Yeah, the House plan was clearly unconstitutional if you read past Supreme Court rulings on what they can do and what they can't do. Theirs was, in a way, better than the Senate plan because it wasn't really mean. It was just trying to protect themselves. The Senate plan was somewhat mean. It wasn't nearly as unconstitutional. May not have been unconstitutional at all, to be honest with you. But it was clearly meaner. It simply changed the district number of Kathy Stein of Lexington, which would have forced her out of office for 2 years. It put the liberals in the Louisville Highlands in Republican Ernie Harris's district. It was just aimed at getting people's goat. And it did that pretty well, and we'll see what they do this next time on this. I'll point out, we skipped over some people that we could have added. Barbara Shanklin and her grandson, Gary Bowler, who was working for Ms. Shanklin, who is a member of the Louisville Metro Council, and was charging taxpayers for time worked while he was in jail. So, you know.
All right, Joe Gerst, fifth annual Leftover Turkeys column. You can find it at CourierJournal.com. Joe's going to stay with us because we're going to bring Kenny Colston in here, Kentucky Public Radio Frankfort Bureau Chief, to talk about some goings-on in Frankfort this week, GOP Senate leadership elections. Kenny, Robert Stivers elected the Senate president. So what would that mean for how the Senate works now?
Well, it seems pretty apparent based to talking to Stivers, the new leadership team, even Speaker Stumbo, that there's going to be some sort of change from David Williams. He had a 13-year career as state Senate president, and a lot of his party will probably look back favorably on his run there, and a lot of people who were his enemies will probably always remember the day he became a judge rather than state Senate president. So there's going to be a change. The question is how does Stivers do that? He has a supermajority that caucus has historically been hard to kind of keep together, but David Williams has been able to do that. And so now that they're quote-unquote a caucus-driven caucus, as the leadership team says, how is that going to be? Are individual members going to be able to derail bills? Are they going to be able to be unanimous or at least have that front that they've talked about for years?
So with David Williams gone, and Joe, I'll pose this question to you. Will the Beshear administration take another run at the casino gambling?
You know, I don't know why they wouldn't. I don't know that there's going to be a great change in the Senate. As Kenny pointed out, Senate President Pro Tem Katie Stein has repeatedly said, you know, this is a caucus-driven caucus. As they have said in the past, what that indicates to me is positions aren't going to change very much, that Stivers may have a little bit different style in leadership. He may be able to sit down across this table from Beshear a little bit better. They can negotiate. They can smile. But in the end, the question is there going to be any great change in the direction of the Senate? And I think only time's going to tell on that.
Go ahead.
There's just a few members. I think the key is going to be that is they're newly elected members. You had a lot of retirements. There's, you know, Williams is gone, but also Vernie McGahey, who's another Southern Kentucky legislator, who they called kind of the conscience of the caucus. And he was kind of like Williams, you know. He was very anti-gambling, but pro-education, was often a guy who in committee meetings would just kind of shake state officials and call them out, never really imposing, but still tough. They've also had, you know, a lot of committee chairmanship open. They had a lot of experience that is retired. And the question is do the new kids with this term and the previous term, what are their positions? Do they step up and try to join, create their own kind of coalition within that caucus? And is the head of that, the new majority floor leader, Damon Thayer, who appears to be a little bit more, moderate on the gambling issue and some other issues?
Yeah, and with Thayer, the question is how much is he going to push for the gambling position from his new position, or was there some sort of a deal cut that hey, you lay low on that and we'll elect you as the floor leader? Don't know what the answer to that is. He indicated that he would not be pushing for someone who favors gambling to take over his old job, and that being the chairman of the state and local government committee, where a gambling bill would be heard.
Before we run out of time, I want to talk quickly about, I know some lawmakers have put forth their legislative priorities and taxing districts, Kenny, has come up in the conversation.
What's that? Auditor Adam Edelin's report on the special taxing districts, Speaker Stumbo announced yesterday that that's going to be House Bill 1, which is generally reserved for whatever the House's biggest priority is. You can point to, I believe, last session that was the pill mill bill, which was a big thing for Stumbo. And that got the pick over pension reform, over tax reform, over redistricting. So apparently, as we've talked about before, billions in dollars of revenue, billions of dollars in holdings that these special taxing districts have. It's going to be 1,000 laws they're going to have to overhaul. But basically, the speaker says we're going to take the auditor's recommendation and try to codify them into law.
Got about 45 seconds left. Is this issue getting much traction outside of Franklin?
Well, I think you've seen pretty much in Pulaski County, there was a, which is in southern Kentucky, they were going almost to dissolve their library board, which is a special taxing district, because they felt like they didn't have control over what was going on down there. And that's kind of weird that someone would basically, that could have shuttered their library. So obviously, these communities, after this report, are looking at their special taxing districts, are feeling emboldened. And I think that probably also had a little bit to do on why House Democrats are saying we really need to look at this.
Kentucky Public Radio, Frankfort Bureau Chief Kenny Colston and Joe Girth of the Courier-Journal. Guys, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
This is Byline on WFPL. When Dr. Eben Alexander awoke from a meningitis-induced coma, he spoke of a journey he took during his illness. He traveled to another world on a butterfly's wing, he claimed, and interacted with an all-knowing divine being. Alexander says his brain was not capable of any activity or hallucination at this time, and his experience, he says, is proof that consciousness exists outside the body and that heaven is real. Alexander's written a book called Proof of Heaven, and his work was also a recent cover story in Newsweek. Alexander's been criticized for seeing his experience as scientific proof of the afterlife, and he talked with WFPL's Gabe Bullard about skeptics and whether or not his claim can be considered science.
Dr. Mark Cohen with UCLA's Department of Bioengineering, he says, in response to your article, science cannot explain brain-free consciousness. Of course, science cannot explain consciousness anyway. In this case, however, it would be parsimonious to reject the whole idea of consciousness in the absence of brain activity. Either his brain was active when he had these dreams, or they are a confabulation of whatever took place in his state of minimally conscious coma. There are many reports of people remembering dreamlike states while in medical coma. They lack consistency, of course, but there's nothing particularly unique in Dr. Alexander's unfortunate episode.
Well, I would say he's absolutely wrong. There's no way my brain could have come up with this very rich realm that it came up with. And that was the part that was so stunning to me that I tried to explain based on every explanation that the kind of skeptical neuroscientific crowd would try and lay into this one. And the problem is none of them work.
Is it dangerous, you think, as a scientist, to approach then with that conclusion already in mind?
Well, the thing is, I originally assumed that there would be a brain-based mechanism. I mean, that's what I spent all those many months researching, was saying there has to be a neuroscientific explanation for how this happened in my brain. That was my conclusion. And the problem is, when I went through every possibility, I ended up realizing, no, that actually this very real experience happened outside my brain, outside of physical reality, and that makes the most sense. It makes far more sense than kind of backpedaling and trying to say, well, it had to happen in his brain because I won't believe that anything else is possible.
What will you say if neuroscientists are able to develop a different theory of consciousness? I mean, a lot of the science we're working with now, even 20 years ago, didn't exist. So what would you say 20 to 50 years from now, if there is an explanation for what happened to you that does not involve anything supernatural?
Well, I think science, neuroscience, is going to have tremendous progress in coming years. But I also know that the scientists making the most progress now already realize that consciousness is not local. They already realize that they need to study phenomena like remote viewing, out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, after-death communications. They have to really start getting knowledgeable about all those phenomena that are real phenomena. If you simply deny them, then you're really not on a pathway towards truth. But if you admit those phenomena exist and then start to work on how we can explain them and consciousness, then we're on the right path. And what I can tell you is, from a totally physicalist standpoint, you know, electrons, protons, neutrons, quarks, and photons as being the basis of all reality, That's not true. And if you go at it with just that physicalist viewpoint, you'll never understand consciousness. To simply say, well, I cannot explain it based in physicalist science, therefore it cannot exist, when physicalist science has no clue how consciousness originates, I would say is a pretty weak position to be in.
It sounds, in a way, as if you're describing polar reversal of science, quote-unquote science, in the Middle Ages, when faith was driving everything.
Well, I would say that really, I mean, to make sense of my whole experience, I have to look back through at least 2,500 years of human history. And what I see is that we actually are on a very long arc towards truth, and that we've taken a little detour here for probably the better part of 400 years, and certainly the last 100 years, towards this complete worship of physicalist science, which does have its attributes, but also is limited. And it's limited mostly because it has no idea how to explain consciousness.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time, Doctor.
Okay. Well, thank you.
That was Dr. Eben Alexander speaking with WFPL's Gabe Bullard about heaven. You'll find more at WFPL.org. Some call it the Journalist Bible, and it's safe to say the Associated Press style book is the go-to reference on word usage for most U.S. newsrooms. This week, the AP announced the next edition of its style book would recommend against using the word homophobia in political and social contexts. Editors say homophobia is imprecise since the word phobia actually means an irrational, uncontrollable fear, and a phobia is an anxiety disorder. Jason Gardner and Kyla Story, hosts of WFPL's Strange Fruit podcast, spoke with U of L psychology professor Dr. Kevin Chapman, who specializes in anxiety disorders, about the change.
For years, researchers and clinicians both know that the term is a misnomer for one. Because when we say anything fill-in-the-blank phobia, it doesn't make sense to say that unless, if I have to be technical for 1 second, a phobia is defined as a marked and persistent fear of one or more situations or objects. Okay? So basically what that means is that if there's a thing or a situation that I place myself in and I have panic attack-like symptoms, so which is the same thing as the fear response. If I have those every time I encounter fill in the blank, or if I have those anxiety symptoms about what if I encounter fill in the blank, then that could warrant the diagnosis of any kind of phobia. So if you want to be technical, it doesn't make any sense, because the fear response and the panic response is not what we often see when we say, quote unquote, homophobia anyway, because that's really kind of a misnomer in terms of that's not really a diagnosable thing to begin with.
My initial reaction as to hearing the update from the AP, certainly as someone who's an LGBT activist, I'm like, you know, no, so-and-so is homophobic, or no, so homophobia does exist. Mm-hmm. But I understand certainly what Dr. Chapman is saying. I think that even in cases, for example, the gay panic defense, which was really popular in the early 90s and 2000s, where because I came on to someone who was heterosexual, you know, he beat me in the head with a pipe wrench, and so gay panic. And so they would often say, well, homophobia is a fear. And so-and-so was genuinely afraid that Jason came on to him. And so I think that maybe to that defense, we say, well, look, homophobia, you know, this person who claims a gay panic defense, for example, has never been diagnosed with homophobia. So that can't be.
Right.
Does that make sense? Am I reaching Dr. Chapman or what?
You totally make sense. And I think the key component of what we're talking about, Jay, is this. Again, to be diagnosed with a phobia is an anxiety disorder. So let's be clear. So it's one thing to have that fear in a situation where it's like, okay, they are legitimately afraid. But the issue is the anxiety component. Anxiety is future oriented, meaning what if something happens? Mm-hmm. What if I encounter a situation that takes place? If I encounter someone who is gay, for instance.
What if I go into this elevator and go to the top floor? What if, the lights go out and okay.
So if you think about it in terms of base rates, right. So base rates, is that legitimate? Like, how many people do we honestly know would say, oh no, next week, if I'm on my business trip and encounter someone who's gay in the elevator, then I'm going to have a panic attack. If you think about it like that, it makes absolutely no sense.
So then perhaps what is a better way to define what we know, have known to be homophobia, not a fear of, but the dislike of LGBT folk? What is a better term?
I think heterosexist is a good one based on what we're saying. I think that if we get to the root of what the emotion is and what it is that the person actually experiences, then I think that we'd be able to, in other words, I guess if we really thought about it long and hard, it'd be a different categories and semantics used to describe what it is that person is ultimately saying they're afraid of. Because that's going to vary from individual to individual, if that makes sense.
Well, let me ask you this. How do the words that we use for things affect the way we think about them? How important is naming a situation, an anxiety, an individual, a persuasion, a perspective, an orientation? How important is what we call things to how we feel about them?
That's a beautiful question on a number of different levels. From a psychological perspective, I always say this in multicultural psychology, to describe is to prescribe. And what I mean by that is whether or not we know it or not, at a subconscious level, the way we describe something really reflects our value system. It really does at the end of the day. If you remove the veil and unpeel all the layers, really the way you call somebody anything or say a thing or describe a person as fill in the blank, that really tells somebody, it gives a glimpse into their value system and what they really think about themselves, the world, and others in general. Some people get offended by that if you say that, but again, I'm a clinician, so if you really remove the veil, you see that firsthand, because if you get them to talk long enough, they'll prove their point ultimately.
That was psychology professor Dr. Kevin Chapman speaking with Kyla Story and Jason Gardner. To hear the rest of the interview, listen to Strange Fruit this Saturday on WFPL. We're going to take a break, but when we come back in our arts segment, we'll hear from the 2013 winner of the prize for the Grawemeyer Award, I should say, for religion, awarded by the University of Louisville and the Presbyterian Theological Seminary here in Louisville. And also, we'll talk to Wendell Castle, celebrating his 80th birthday. He's a master craftsman and sculptor who will open an exhibit tonight at the Kentucky Museum of Art and Craft. It's all coming up next. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. The winner of the 2013 Grawemeyer Religion Award is Dr. Leila Ahmed, a feminist scholar and Harvard University Divinity Professor. Ahmed is being honored for her work examining why a growing number of Muslim women in the United States are choosing to wear veils as a visible symbol of social justice and change. WFPL's Aaron Keene spoke with Ahmed about her book, A Quiet Revolution, The Veil's Resurgence from the Middle East to America. Ahmed began her research by trying to understand how the veil, which was passé in her childhood in Egypt, became popular later in her homeland and how it traveled across the ocean to the United States.
And it turned out to be something that actually liberated women in Egypt. It gave them the right to be in public places in ways that they hadn't been before, because they could say, look, I'm Islamically dressed. You have no right to prevent me being working in an office with men or doing whatever, you know. So it actually enabled them to be active, and it was this stream of Islam that came to America in the 60s as the immigration laws changed, and lots of young people were fleeing from, in those days, Nasser and he was very kind of repressive towards this Muslim Brotherhood. So a lot of them fled and came to America, and they began to found organizations here, Islamic organizations. In fact, you know, all the major organizations of today in America, the ISNA and a whole lot of others, were founded by people from this background, and they became the place that controlled the mosques in which young people, young American Muslims, went for their Sunday school.
And so how does the veil then in a country like the U.S. where women do have the freedom to work in an office, to be out in public without necessarily having to declare their, have an outward symbol of their piety in order to protect them, how does the veil take on a different cultural and religious significance here?
Well, absolutely wonderful question. And the key issue there is it's the dress of a minority. And a minority who, after 9/11 in particular, suffered for the fact that they were Muslim, and even before, because as a minority, one needs to bear in mind that it's as much a dress of African American Muslims as of immigrant Muslims, and it's a way of asserting your dignity against the majority culture, which looks down on you. When I interviewed people would say to me, particularly after 9/11, that they wore it as a way, they had not worn it before they took on wearing it. First they would say, well, because they now believe that Islam requires it, but they would also say, I want to say to people, I'm proud to be Muslim, and and you're wrong, and I want to be, if I want people to come up to me and ask me, why are you wearing hijab, and to explain to them, it's not oppression, it's choice, and it's a way of standing up for my rights. So it's a visual sign to the rest of society. It's like the afro. They also wear it for feminist reasons. I mean, one person I asked, she said, well, and I see, and I'm wearing my hijab, and I see people staring at me, women, other women looking at me, wondering, thinking pityingly about my dress. I think, well, maybe the sight of me will make them aware of just how sexist our society is and how they dress and think it's not sexist.
There's a sort of a pervasive assumption also that feminism and Islam are mutually exclusive, in the same way that there's an assumption that feminism and many religions are sort of at odds with each other.
You're absolutely right to say that the assumption logically should be that many religions, but somehow Islam gets singled out. I mean, of course, it's just as contradictory on the surface to be a Christian feminist or a Jewish feminist as it is to be a Muslim feminist. And you're right, but people tend to think it is Islam and feminism in particular are incompatible. And I think, obviously, as your question implies, they're no more incompatible than any other of the major religions.
Dr. Leila Ahmed is the winner of the 2013 Grawemeyer Award for Religion. She spoke with WFPL's Aaron Keene. And now we are speaking with WFPL's Aaron Keene because she has joined us in the studio with some special guests to talk about a new exhibit at the Kentucky Museum of Art and Craft. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Rick. Thanks a lot. I'm here with Wendell Castle and Joey Yates. Joey, you have curated the exhibit, Wendell Castle, Form Within Forms, the 21st Century, which opens tonight at the Kentucky Museum of Art and Craft. Can you just tell us a little bit about, this is Wendell's 80th birthday. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Fantastic year. This is one of four major exhibits that are happening this year in celebration of your work. And so, Joey, if you'd like to just let us know why KMAC decided to stage this exhibit.
Well, to join that roster of concurrent exhibitions was an honor and a privilege. And so we, you know, took that job on, that exhibition on. And also he's the perfect artist for us to show right now as we're trying to, you know, expand a lot of the dialogue about art, craft, and design. And this is just was the perfect timing for the show.
So, Wendell, you're described as a master craftsman and sculptor, and your work is situated at the intersection of fine art and furniture design, two things that perhaps a lot of people might think are not exactly in the same family. How would you describe yourself?
Well, I do fall into the sort of a crack between a couple of categories, the design world and the art world, but they've become much closer together in the last 10 years, and that division is smaller and smaller all the time. And the audience for cutting-edge, we're talking about cutting-edge design, not people who design electric razors or
right.
car handles, but, you know, cutting-edge design, which is awfully close to being the same as fine arts, except these pieces can, for the most part, be actually used. You can actually sit in the chair or actually put something on the table, so they're usable.
And so what is it about functional design and art that appeals to you as a sculptor, as a maker of things?
Well, I don't think there's anything about the functional part.
Okay.
I think the kind of way that I got into doing this in the first place and the way I still think about it is that every artist looks for a unique place to put their work where you're just not falling into the same kind of category as anyone else, and that your work has a certain distinction that sets it apart. And back when I began, there wasn't really anybody doing this hybrid form of art which falls between sculpture and furniture. Mm-hmm. And if there's a part that suffers, it is the function. But in my work, it'll never suffer to the extent that makes it unusable.
So how have you seen the design field changed then since you came up in the mid-20th century during, I guess, the rise of that sort of what now looks very iconic to us, that mid-century modern design period?
Well, it's changed enormously in the time I've been working, but early on it was very hard to figure out where I should try to exhibit. Mm. I did find early on a good gallery representation in New York City, But museum exhibitions or things that with themes and what on, I would sort of never fit. And then there was really no design as art community at that point. But there was a community of people who dealt with craft. Mm-hmm. And there were some exhibition opportunities in that context. So in the early years, it was mostly in that context. Although now I really prefer not to even call myself a craftsman or think that I have much to do with craft, although I certainly do want to make things that are well made. But that is not the issue. That's what they look like is what's important.
Well, and so your work is in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It's mm-hmm. been in the Renwick Gallery, the Smithsonian, MoMA. What changed then in the art field that let design in?
Well, gradually there would be museums that would buy my things. But that started quite a long time ago. Mm-hmm. That I did begin to be collected, which was wonderful. And, you know, nowadays, I mean, probably back a few years ago, I would get a piece in a museum every 3 or 4 years. Now I'll get 3 or 4 pieces in a museum in 1 year. So there's a big change.
Joey, as a museum professional, then, how do you see the art museums opening up to design in the same way that KMAC is open to both art and craft?
Well, larger museums are able to kind of classify the objects they collect or that they exhibit, whether it is design or it's painting or sculpture or photography. We kind of have a privilege in a way to always do exhibitions that combine all those things, mm-hmm. And to show that those classifications don't always have to stand. You know, you can mend these projects by different artists into the same exhibition. And so, you know, Wendell's work occupies all of those spaces. So it's good for us to be able to show him now.
Well, I was reading some of the modernists and talking about architecture and design, and during that movement, and George Nelson said something that really stuck out to me: that good design relates to the techniques and living habits of a period. Is that a maximum that you follow in your artistic work?
To some extent, I believe that any artwork is a result of what's happening at that particular time in history, whether that's whatever it is. You know, that you cannot help but have some reaction to things that are happening around you and the things you see happening all over the world. Then influences from probably everything you read, see, hear, may impact your work.
And so how does a piece like a wooden table sculpture reflect that sort of current state of being and living?
Well, you know, the way I would approach that is that I think that the vocabulary of art, certain shapes and forms, are more of their time than other shapes. The fact of a piece right now, I think of everything as being kind of dark, not both literally and figuratively. So I'm really kind of thinking dark thoughts.
Dark thoughts.
And so that manifests itself in various ways. It never makes sense to describe things very well because a table offers opportunities for sculpture. The obvious thing you cannot do is put it all over the top because then it wouldn't be a table anymore. Mm. You need to put it underneath or beside it. So you do have, and I have done two different things. With tables, chairs are a lot more fun. And much more interesting to make than tables. But in tables, you can get things to work sculpturally. One is put a big hole in the middle of the table so you can see what's happening underneath. The other is to put the legs off to the side of the table so there are no legs under the table. The legs are all off to the side, and the legs don't look like legs. They look like solid forms that are formed into sculpture.
That sounds very fun to me, but what's more fun about a chair than a table?
Well, a flat is not interesting.
Ah, okay.
Flat is flat.
Yeah.
There are no flats in a chair.
Right.
And the sculptural quality that you can put within a seat, even though we have to respect the shape of the human,
yes,
it needs to be a certain height off the floor, and it needs to have some slant in the seat, and you put the lumbar region in the right place, you need enough room. But even with that, you can do so much with everything else. That, I mean, I think I have chairs that from the rear, if you'd never seen it before, you wouldn't have any idea what you're looking at. You would never know that was a chair.
Well, the exhibit at Kentucky Museum of Art and Craft opens tonight at 7 p.m. Joey, you're going to be interviewing Wendell at KMAC. And so if ever the public is invited to come, and will there be opportunities to ask questions?
There will.
Fantastic. So come on out and find out more about Wendell Castle's Form Within Forms, the 21st Century. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron, and thank you, too, for joining us, and happy birthday, Wendell. You can read Aaron Keene's blog, ArtCraft, at WFPL.org. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about topics discussed on Byline, you can visit our website, WFPL.org. Byline is produced by the WFPL News staff. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Howlett. Have a good weekend.